Thank you for coming to this panel discussion of letters and documents, Volume 1 of the Parley Pratt Papers. Before we begin, we're going to have our panel tell us their name and a little bit about themselves. So we'll just start here.
Oh, okay. My name is Robert Stephen Pratt. I go by Steve Pratt. I'm probably the major reason we're all here today because I am the person who began basically the Parley P. Pratt Papers thing. I need to talk louder, right? I was a graduate student in history. I'm the White Laws one. I
did get a degree in history, master's degree. I have a MBA from Boston. I started through history, but I didn't quite finish my history degree in from BYU. I was a comptroller for the U.S. Army. I worked for the U.S. Army for 43 years. This project I started with the collections, and we'll talk more about that later. I'm married, of course, have a wife and 7 children, and 13 grandchildren, you see. I'm very proud of that, and so I'll leave it at that.
Alex Baugh, down at BYU, Church History and Doctrine. I'm the only non-Pratt person here. And I just have to tell you, probably one of the finest compliments I've ever received was in a class I was teaching at BYU, and I was trying to find the photograph here, but you're probably all familiar with it. I know these brethren are. But it's a picture of Parley P. Pratt, and it's a profile. He's standing, I think it's that same picture, except he turns the other way. And I can't even remember, we were talking about the Mission of the Lamanites or something, and I had that profile picture up. And one of my students says, "Professor Baugh, if you had a few more sideburns, you'd look exactly like Parley P. Pratt." I had this little bit of hair right here. It's no longer there. And I thought, boy, Pratt's my hero. This is. I gave that student an A. So that's all that was needed. But I guess the reason I'm on this is, number one, I do love Parley P. Pratt, and I've always been mesmerized by his missionary experiences. And, you know, you just can't go through life without hearing about Stew Boy. And
I'm going to talk about that.
Okay. And then I have a question about it. So, but anyway, where I became really, really intensely interested is I felt like his story of the Richmond, of his incarceration, we always talked about the Liberty Jail prisoners, and we never talked about the Richmond Jail prisoners. So I got involved in that, and then, of course, I've known Steve for a number of years, and he and Matt were putting this book together on Parley P. Pratt, and I guess you helped on that, didn't you, Steve?
Yeah,
of course you did. But Matt was one of the editors on Parley P. Pratt and the Making of Mormonism, published by Oklahoma Press. And so I did the article or the chapter on Parley P. Pratt's Missouri imprisonment letters. So I thank Steve for letting me be on this panel, but I just really admire this great, great man.
My name is Mitch Pratt, and I'm here because Steve called, and he said, "Mitch, I need 4 guys." And so I'm here.
He's my first cousin.
I've known Steve for a very long time. Yes, his dad and my dad were brothers. And I think, even though my father was very interested in Parley, I think some of the things that resonated with me was when we would end up in Tooele, and Uncle Bob would get going on family history, and it would be such a wonderful experience to listen to him. Alex, we adopt you.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, yes, that's fine. But I do have to tell one story. In the olden days, you used to have somebody called a general authority visit your state conference. And in those days, particularly, you'd get one every state conference. Some of you are nodding your head like you remember that. And so my dad who was the bishop of the ward at the time, and was always the one who cooked the meals for the visiting dignitaries. And we had this young whippersnapper coming by the name of Tom Monson. And my dad figured, I'm going to impress this guy. He's coming from Salt Lake City. And so in a moment they were alone, and Dad goes, you know, Brother Monson, Parley P. Pratt was my great-grandfather. Brother Monson goes, yeah, and there's a million of them. So I'm not sure how special that makes us, but anyway, we're glad to be here.
Thank you for those introductions. If we can start by having you tell us about the origins of the papers, and specifically what is significant about Pratt that would warrant a papers project.
Well, I'm going to have to do that. This project actually began, like he said, 1971, 1972. It actually began from a situation. I was a senior in college and having to write a history paper. And so when I did that, and I'll try to make it short, Matt. I know you have I have a problem with that. But as I was doing that, Parley P. Pratt was murdered. He was murdered out in Arkansas in 1857. And so that was the topic of my paper. And so I went to the church office building to try to look at the extent of Parley P. Pratt's papers. And there was one box of Parley P. Pratt papers. That was it. It had some journals, a few letters, stuff like that. That was it, seriously. Okay. And so then I went out, and since I'm a Pratt, there was a lady up in the Avenues area of Salt Lake named Dorothy Topham. Dorothy Topham was Parley P. Pratt Jr.'s granddaughter. She had all of Parley P. Pratt Jr.'s material. And so what happened is I went to her house, and you remember there was only one set of papers in the church office building. And so I interviewed Dorothy, and she went back into her little closet, and she pulled out a box, and there were letters, journal. She had the original little certificate signed by Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery when he was ordained, right after he was ordained an apostle. The certificate doesn't talk about apostleship at all. And so I asked Dorothy, what are you doing with these? And she says, well, I don't know. You know, can I use them in my research on the Parley P. Pratt murder? And of course, they were letters and all kinds of stuff. And then she gave me contacts with several family members who had letters and various things in the family. And now, what happened when I did my letter, when I did my situation with the in my senior paper, Dorothy let me borrow those documents. Can you imagine? She handed them to me. So when I went into my seminar session with my fellow compadres, and I told them about my topic, I brought this box of letters. And you should have seen the reaction of people when I opened that box and I pulled out the letters and journals and all kinds of stuff. And so then they got rather excited. I finished my little paper. Luckily, it was published, so if you want to go back in BYU Studies in 1975, you'll find my little paper. Then what I did right at that particular time, I went around to the family. I went around to several people, and I gathered several parts of Parley P. Pratt's papers. I went not only... And then at that time, Dorothy Topham, there was a little organization that the Pratts have called the Jared Pratt Family Organization. At that particular time, Amy Pratt Romney was the historian.
So she says, Steve, would you like to be the historian for the Jared Pratt Family Organization? And I said, yeah, I guess. And so I went over and visited with Amy. Amy Pratt Romney had a bunch of stuff, and I got the material from them. So to make the story, the long story short, I gathered material from all of the family. I got that from Dorothy. She gave me all that stuff. Eventually, I gave it back to her, and I persuaded her to turn the documents over to the church office, that me over to the church library. I went to other people who had Parley P. Pratt material. When they found out that I was going to do that, then I got several letters from people through my contacts with Dorothy Topham to bring all the various letters together. The church office building was awful excited. That was during the Leonard Arrington days. And so I was turning a bunch of material into the church, a whole bunch of Pratt material. I went up to Ogden, and I'm going to show you something that's very interesting. It's kind of neat. Out in the foyer, I just went up and did one thing, and I said, well, I went up to Ogden, and I found the Orson Pratt family. Of course, you can't get a Parley P. Pratt letter to himself, generally, but if you can get one to Orson, so I went to an Orson Pratt family group up there, and they gave me copies of all of the papers that they had. And see, just out in the foyer out here with one of the guys that is the rare book thing, he says, do you realize that I have an original Parley P. Pratt letter? And so he showed it to me. And there it is. And it is October the 30th, 1853, Matt. Now, this letter, instead of the Orson Pratt people turning the originals in, they turned copies into the church office building and retained the originals. And so when the old ancestor died, the old person who had the one that I went to 40 years ago, then it was kept in the family. And so the guy says, I asked him, where did you get this letter? And he said, well, one of the sons of the guy had it. So what I did, so let me give you an extract of the price of this. So to make a long story short in that, all of these documents, I got them turned into the church office building. I had them all done. So after I finished my degree, I was a graduate student. My topic, of course, would be Parley P. Pratt. I've got all these documents. I can use them, okay? And so I was going to the church office building a lot to at first write a biography of Parley P. Pratt. But when I was in the church office building one day, I think it was one of the guys says, we've got plenty of biographies. Pratt wrote an autobiography. A better thing would be some sort of documentary sort of thing. Since you have all these documents that you've helped turn in, why don't you prepare something to in that realm? So I did that. The first ones that I did, which I gave to Alex years later, and they actually put this in the church office. I took all of the jail letters. I introduced all the jail letters, and then I annotated them and all the rest of it. I even pulled all the Missouri documents from the from Boone County and all the rest of it, and I had this thing set. I had a little, it would be like the Missouri letters. And so what took place with that, then I went to a guy by the name of Davis Bitten. I showed it to him, and I says, well, what do you think? And he said, this is marvelous. He says, you need to talk to a guy by the name of Dean Jesse. Dean Jesse at that time was doing documentary history. He had just published a thing called Brigham Young's Letters to His Sons, all that sort of thing. He was working on Joseph Smith. And so Dean Jesse and I, this is the beginning of this collection, Dean Jesse and I, the church then gave me access to most everything inside the church archives. So I was going to the church archives a lot. I was pulling all of the papers from each one of the people, Brigham Young,
all of the people there. I was trying to find any letter from Parley P. Pratt. I was like a bird dog. I found everything. Now, you can imagine. I went through every collection, everything, and I gathered them all. Now, Dorothy's material that she had before, she had a bunch of stuff. She had all of his financial records. She had all of the rest of that. And so there was, so that is the beginning of this. I started into this, and I even had an agreement back in the 1980s when Matt was working with the at that particular time to get the project done. Matt and Dean were on, I went to Germany working for the U.S. Army, so I took all the collection over to Germany, and I had one collection of all these papers on this side, and I had a collection on Germany side. And so, and Matt, our agreement we had that I would complete the stuff up to 1847, Matt and Dean would do the stuff from 1847 to the end of his life. Now, that project didn't happen. It wasn't completed, okay? And so what took place was they more or less completed, by and large, the second half. But he didn't have enough time to really do a lot of detail work, you know what I'm talking about. And so, but that's fine, it doesn't matter. But the first half, I wasn't able to totally complete by then. And so then, when the Joseph Smith papers began, there was a situation where my project was still there. And so Ron Esplin came to me right at a particular time and says, frankly, we do not have enough resources to do both of these collections. You will help you find a publisher, we'll help you with this particular situation, but we've got to concentrate on Joseph Smith. So if you went to my house, I've got tons of material on Pratt. I've got everything he ever wrote, everything he ever said. I've got all of his discourses, and through the help of Matt here, and through the very, very big cooperation, I think I've got the most complete collection that there is of Parley P. Pratt. And so that's basically it. Now, maybe I can describe the volumes that I think we're going to publish, and so we can give you an extent of what we have.
The other question that Sherilyn asked was, why a documentary editing project on Pratt, right? So why is Pratt important enough to merit the sort of effort that takes into that is required to do a documentary editing project? And I think I would frame that in a couple of different ways. One, I would say that Pratt is a very perceptive observer. Right, so the quality of the documents, the quality of his observations, of his journals, his letters is quite high, right? So that's the sort of the first reason I would say, that's that the quality of the material is really good. The second thing I think I would say is that Pratt is, he has this kind of interesting relationship with kind of the center and the periphery of the early church, right? So sometimes he's absolutely at the center, engaged in, you know, the important decision making happening in Kirtland or Nauvoo or wherever, but then he also gives you this very unique perspective on early Mormon missionary work, right? So he stays longer than any of the apostles in the British Isles in 1840 to 1842. Before then, he's all over the United States. He's up in Canada. He spends a good amount of time in New York. And then the 1850s, and this was material I found really interesting, is he spends so much time in Gold Rush, San Francisco. And when he's in San Francisco, he's supervising missionary work throughout the whole Pacific, right? So he's corresponding with Australia and Hawaii. And so there's this really interesting international dynamic as the church is sort of pivoting away from just a purely Anglo-American missionary effort to an international effort. And then, of course, you throw on top of that his mission to Chile, right? So the first kind of foray into Latin America. So I'd say the quality of Pratt as an observer, kind of the scope of his activities, and I think the third way I'd frame that question is that in many ways Pratt becomes the voice of the early church to the world, right? So if you want to understand the early intellectual history of the church, your early cultural history, you really have to understand what Pratt is doing, right? I mean, Voice of Warning, 1837, Key of the Science of Theology, 1855, so that kind of bookends his writing career. But he's such an important pamphleteer, such an important thinker and theologian, and the letters and the journals really give insight and context and all of that.
That's actually a perfect segue to my next question, was the sense of the documentary record. Tell us about that and some of the types of records that that readers will see in the Pratt papers, and kind of give us a sense of the parameters of the project. Obviously, for this panel, we're talking specifically about Letters and Documents, Volume 1, but what should readers expect for the trajectory of this project?
Well, okay. Basically, in one, it's every kind of document. Our first thing was letters, but I've incorporated both letters and like a minute record sort of thing with the letters, because I felt that would be important to put in. But to give you some context of the content of the thing. Just after Pratt's murder, but George A. Smith didn't know this, I have a little document which I can't find I copied it years ago, but I can't go to the church office building and know where it is. But anyway,
we haven't lost it,
but here we go.
We have a good catalog.
Okay, when Pratt died, so we're talking about the collection. Pratt, when he went out in the Eastern States Mission at the very end, he was going to publish his autobiography. He wasn't able to do it. Now, when I think of publishing his autobiography, I think, well, there's a couple of papers he took, and that isn't true. And I've got a whole article on the source material of the autobiography, which I'm going to publish, but I'll just really quickly, I'll read this little document to you, and it'll give you a perspective of the situation. List the books, papers delivered by George A. Smith to Parley P. Pratt Jr. May the 30th, 1857. Now, Pratt was killed on the 13th of May. And so I know that George A. didn't know he was dead. And so, miscellaneous letters, 1817. Small pocketbook, book containing copies of the letters from 1855 and 56, large envelope and of the power of attorney, Parley P. Pratt's letters of appointments, copyright to the Key to Theology, Journal 1857, Book of Correspondence of the Pacific Mission, Journal 1851, History from the Scenes of Prison, 1839 to 51, and the Parley P. Pratt History, which was a 300-page document that was done by George Q. Cannon. George Q. Cannon was the scribe when Pratt put that together. Now, how many of these documents do we have? 1,817 letters. I've got 452 letters. I don't think there are any of these letters because of what they are. They're family letters that I have mainly, and then letters to other people or those from him. Do we have the copies of letters from 55 and 50? No. Do we have the book of the correspondence of the Pacific? We have the Pacific Mission correspondence, but not the book. The 1857 journal, we do not have it. The original manuscript of the Parley P. Pratt History, we do not have it. Okay, and so that's why I did a little article on going through the autobiography and everything, because Pratt took most of his autobiography from previous printed sources or previous stuff, and that's what he incorporated in his autobiography. So on the parameters of the project, we're going to have 10 volumes of documents, okay,
then we're probably going to have two volumes of journals. There's probably six journals that he had. I've got 165 poems that Pratt wrote. Okay, so we'll have a volume of poetry. Then I've got a big question mark after one called Writings, because he is so prolific. But we've got a bunch of unpublished writings, like the conversation between Elijah and a mortal man. We've got a play that he wrote. We've got all kinds of stuff like that that we can incorporate into maybe a volume or two. And then I think the discourses, and through the help of Matt and other people, I've got every discourse that he ever gave, even the ones that are in where he wrote it out. And so that's the extent of the collection. The first one that we have represents 80 documents. There's 11 appendices. In the appendices, I don't know if they're going to do this. I've got the, I guess I could put it up on the screen. I won't do that. But I've got the Missouri material from jail. I've got all of the indictment statements. I've got all of the change of venue stuff. I've got all of the bill, etc. I thought that would be a good addition as an appendix, so that when you get into the jail period, you've got a complete thing on that jail period.
So Stephen, in terms of what you shared with the panel, which was a draft of the first book that you're working on. So it's 80 documents, some appendices. What's the time span involved?
Well, we were hoping that it would be published.
No. I mean the time span of the letters.
Oh, okay. The time span of the letters. I'm sorry. It's from the beginning of his life until 1840, when he goes to England. I've got an April 6th, 1840 letter when he lands in England. Okay, and then the first actual letter that we have that he wrote is 1835. Now we know he wrote letters before, but I've got documents from the earlier period that are other things.
Have you needed to cut any documents out? Of course, you know, my work on the Joseph Smith papers, you always have this, you always fight this issue of bulk, and you have to decide which, in a letterpress volume, which documents are you going to publish, and which are you like, golly, we don't have enough room in this volume, or that kind of thing?
I really like that question, because I'm struggling with that.
Sure.
So what I've done, though, is I've introduced all of the documents. And so if they want to cut out something, we make a decision, we're going to cut out something, then we just cut it out. But then I'm thinking, how do we get the material out? So. Yeah.
Alex had a comment.
I had a question on that too. Now, Steve has put together this really excellent collection. We have a lot of times we have minutes of a meeting where he's just mainly mentioned, and I'm not questioning that, because it does fills in some gaps. For example, these high council minute meetings minute meetings over there in Jackson County.
Right.
Boy, those are great, because they really do fill in a picture that we
have very few documents.
Yeah. And so that really is helpful. But I think some of them are just Parley P. Pratt was there.
Yeah.
And that he's in there, but it didn't do a whole lot for me. But that was my question. Which ones could you probably say, well, yeah, we know he's that in that meeting on, you know, in Kirtland in 1836, you know, before he left.
But yeah, didn't you find though some of the introductions that Steve?
Oh, very good. There? Yeah, Steve's.
As far as those minutes go, though, they do fill in a tremendous amount of information that we just simply didn't have. For me, it was just a matter of going through and saying, okay, I had some gaps in my understanding, and there were several aha moments. When, particularly in the introductions, where some of those are filled in. But I agree, Alex, that some of those minutes are less than...
A little scant, but...
Yeah.
And Sherilyn and Matt can also talk on that, because I think there were things of the Joseph Smith papers, you go, well, maybe it's just not worth putting it in that Joseph Smith was there, or you know, that kind of thing. So anyway.
Right. This isn't about the Joseph Smith papers, Alex. About our editorial policies.
Alex, we could talk about document selection for the Joseph Smith papers
all
day.
I'm going to lock you in a room with Mark and Sherilyn afterwards, and you'll come out a supporter.
How's the project different? So,
yeah. What kind of, in terms of the approach for the paper, for the Parley Pratt papers, though, you know, if we were going to make a comparison with the Joseph Smith papers, which folks in the audience may be aware of the papers project and the Joseph Smith papers project and how things are organized and presented there, how is this going to differ from that in terms of, you know, say its style or the way in which you're organizing the material or that kind of thing?
I'm actually following their format because the format was originated with Dean Jesse. Yeah. And so we've got a little introduction to each document. It isn't just a letter book and you've got a big introduction and you go, oh, here's all these letters and thank you very much. I'm introducing each document. Okay. Then because there's so many people that Pratt introduces, I've got a biographical register. Now these guys got excited when they saw it because I got 300 people in there. And I don't have a lot in there, but I realize how these guys have an advantage of all the genealogists out there writing these little biographies, which I'm the genealogist. And so it was kind of unwielding, but I've been working on this for 40 years, guys. And so I've been able to put together some of that stuff. So most of the biographies I've written, I've got to ferret him down because the guys at Coleford says he's too big. We've got to figure out what to do when we get all these documents. The current printed thing of this thing is 800 pages. We don't even have an index or any of the rest of that in there, and so it's, you know.
Well, and I don't think anyone should underestimate the value of the power of one individual to do work, as can be testified by the work that Dean Jesse did for so many decades, that it was phenomenal work for a person of one. Yeah. And so
that set the stage.
Yeah. It definitely set the stage, yes. Alex, please.
Well, just to kind of echo then, so what Steve has done, you have used the Joseph Smith papers as kind of a template.
Yes.
He'll have a source note, where can you find this document, where is it located, whatever. And then he provides a historical introduction, and then he provides a typescript with annotation.
Correct.
So I do have one other question, and that is some of the documents are taken from, I mean, some of the documents kind of could be also in the Joseph Smith papers. So I'm wondering how you would deal with that if this document appears in the Joseph Smith papers. How will you make that a little bit different or contributory?
I do. Okay, for example, one important letter that they have in the Joseph Smith papers is the 23rd of May, 1837 letter to Joseph Smith. There are two letters that we have of that. We one from the Zion's Watchman, and then we have one from a later account, which I think is more accurate. The introduction to that letter is mine. I didn't use. Well, I like their introduction, but I've got more. I've got some material in my mind that they may not have looked at, and so it's not going to be the same as the Joseph Smith paper. So when I see a letter, because I had written these introductions before the Joseph Smith papers even wrote these things about that particular letter. There's another one in 1839, the same way. I'd already written an introduction. Right. Now, did they use any of my material in their stuff? The answer is no. And so it'll be mine.
But it stands to reason that there would be that difference because the framework is different.
The framework was Pratt, not Smith,
yes.
Right? So
yes.
There's a different
Pratt,
emphasis.
Not Joseph Smith.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. But you do reference the Joseph Smith papers in your footnotes.
Yeah, and I went back now that I've worked on this for so long, now that they published them, so I'm going back and doing that. Okay.
That's great. Can you tell us a little bit more about where you found these documents? You mentioned earlier Dorothy Toffin had a good chunk of these materials that you utilized in some of this early work that you're doing with Pratt. I presumably some other Pratt descendants had some materials as well as church archives. Are there any other repositories that have had some of these documents, or where are we seeing these, where are these documents trundling from?
Well, most of the documents are in the church office building, because I persuaded the family members to turn them in. Some of the documents are in private collections. The one that I've shown you here was.
Did it walk off?
No, I hope it didn't.
Oh, okay.
And we have some documents.
Does the seller that are know what's
private
gone?
Collections. And what is the value of a Parley P. Pratt original? They're very expensive, by the way. I won't tell you the price of the. I have one document in my poetry that I don't have the document. It's in a private collector, and it's his first poem in his hand. I've got several examples of his poetry in his hand, but this one goes for a substantial price. And when I asked the guy, how much does it? I couldn't come up with that kind of money to pay for it. But
what kind of money are we talking about?
$120,000. And so I says, nah. Yeah.
So in the gathering of these documents, how many are we looking at so far? How many have you gathered?
Okay, I said that before. 452 letters. I've got 165.
I'm terrible at math. Do we have like a someone?
165.
A total.
Poems. Probably 100 writings, sort of thing.
Okay.
There's 5 journals, that sort of thing.
So all right. I'm trying to do the math in my head.
We want to get into the actual stuff, right? Yeah.
Okay. People... All right.
I have a question. I'm kind of questioning Steve here, and it's all good.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you've ever read some of Parley's poems, this is a dimension a lot of people don't know about him. Yeah. My question is, you see this W.W. Phelps... Parley P. Pratt poem where they preach doctrine. They're really good. And I guess maybe it's just one way that he found to express himself in a more creative way, that he comes better over time too.
Yeah, he does.
But you see again, you know, your Eliza R. Snows and others who you just come away going, wow, that is terrific. He writes a poem in jail on his birthday.
Yeah, I can show it.
Oh, it's fantastic. And then, so I'm just very touched by his poetry. And you know, you kind of see this with the LDS Church presidents. You know, Gordon B. Hinckley writes a hymn.
That's the one.
President Nelson has written a hymn that's been put to music. And anyway, I just find him, I'd be very impressed. Or be interested in what you would all say, but I've just kind of had that same motivation. I thought, okay, I've written some things, but I've not been as creative. I think the one way to be really creative is to try to make a poem. And this got in his blood somewhere. And anyway, just a comment or two on maybe his poetry, because it's really, really good.
Well, I can comment just one small thing. He wrote more hymns in the old hymn book than W.W. Phelps or Eliza R. Snow, but in the current situation, they've eliminated most of them, and we're down to 7 in our current hymn book, but he had 33 or 34 in the old hymn book. So
he loses a few every time a new hymnal comes out, so we'll see about this next one.
Based on your understanding of the records of Pratt, what do you consider some of his most valuable contributions to church history and to the church in general, based on the documents, his records that he's written?
Well, I think one of the things that becomes obvious as we look at what he did, he was the person who really kind of took what Joseph said and put it in a way that it could be understood by members of the church. He synthesized it down into a way and made sense of what was going on. For me, that's one of the major contributions that he had to our theology. Made it understandable for us.
Again, I've just mainly focused in on his Missouri period. documents. But I don't know if you know this, but while in the Richmond jail, he wrote the history of the Missouri persecutions. Correct. And I think it's wonderful. It's one of the earliest documents to come out. And he gets, as soon as he gets out of jail, he publishes it up in Detroit, I think it was.
Yeah, it
was. And I mean, that's about as almost as current to the actual incidents as you can come by. And it's a miracle we even have that. The guards in the Richmond jail knew he was probably writing some stuff because he had, and by the way, his wife, Marianne Frost Stearns Pratt, lived with him in the jail for 3 months.
Exactly.
And can you imagine that nowadays? But the point is, he's working on this recounting of what happened in Missouri. And Mary Ann's going to leave the jail in March. She comes in December, I believe it is. And anyway, she's got to get it out without the guards checking her. And she had this pillowcase that I guess she was kind of going to hide it under her dress or something.
Yeah.
And fortunately, there was a tragic diversion. The one of the little girls, I can't remember the girl's name.
Mary Ann
is climbing up the ladder, and the trap door fell on her head. Can imagine, and that created enough fortunately she didn't get too hurt, but that created enough distraction that Mary Ann, the mother, got up and left, and had the manuscript secured. So to answer your question again, Sherilyn, I'm just grateful for what Parley fills in with the Missouri episodes and his Missouri imprisonment and the other Missouri prisoners, and the history he provided there in Missouri. That just has been and that's one reason why I just appreciate him so much.
Well, as we look at that, we look at the human side of things. I mean, Mary Ann, it was an upgrade when she moved into the jail, moving from this little 9-foot by 9-foot hut where it was out in the middle of, and so.
She said.
Yeah.
I looking here, he writes her and says, on December 1st, come on down, we can get you in the jail. And you need not be afraid of the old jail, for it is better than the hut where you now live.
Yeah, yeah.
In Far West. So, and it wasn't even a finished jail. So anyway.
Alex had mentioned this sense of how Pratt creates this, you know, infuses some granularity in this in Missouri jail experience. How are some other ways in which these Pratt papers are going to change our narrative about early church history? And how does it change our narrative about Pratt in particular?
Okay. Let me talk about the autobiography. That's what she's talking about. What is the Pratt in the autobiography versus the Pratt in these papers? There is some differences there in the Pratt in the papers than there is in the autobiography. The autobiography, he intended through the auspices of like the Ben Franklin autobiographies, it's a public view of Pratt. You don't get into the inner man of Pratt through the autobiography. You really don't. And when you get into some of these papers, you get into the rest of the story. An example of, and I'll just cite one small example. Parley P. Pratt and Mary Ann Pratt were divorced. They were divorced in 1853. So when you look at the early Missouri period, you're going to notice in the autobiography, it's interesting what he leaves in the autobiography versus the history of the persecution, where they have that whole incident where she sneaks the thing out, his manuscript out. That's not in the autobiography. And I think it's because of the attitude he had right at that particular time when he wrote that particular thing. Several things that I read where he does not give very much details about a lot of stuff. And he always puts himself in the best possible light. You know, he's not going to get out there and show that he's really crazy. For an example I can give is when he's called to teach the Shakers, and he's out there and he goes to the Shakers, and in his autobiography he says, well, I went to the Shakers and I didn't have much success, and that's basically it.
But I love what's going to be in these documents, because when he goes to the Shakers, well, I've got Asa Bell's Kitchell's little journal when they show up, and they read the revelation. And then Sidney Rigdon is this very, very formal guy. He's kind of not really raising any stir. And when they, after they read the revelation, then you have Asa Bell Kitchell kind of railing against this revelation and saying it's awful. And then you get Parley P. Pratt, he's shaking his dust against them and all this sort of thing. And this is Pratt. Clickable Pratt stuff, see? This is Parley P. Pratt. Now, none of that's in the autobiography. Isn't that fun? And of course, then Asa Bell Kitchell says, "You filthy beast, how dare you stand up and rebuke us?" And then, according to Asa Bell Kitchell, he kind of bows his head a little bit, and then he kind of just wanders off. Now, is that in the autobiography? It doesn't make Pratt look too good, does it? So he didn't put that in there. But he, you know, and I love the Stew Boy thing, too, and I'll tell this one, okay? And this is the difference between Parley P. Pratt. And he doesn't pay his bills very well. So in the Joseph Smith situation, where he comes in and he rents a place, okay, and he gets this property in the 23rd of May, 1837 letter, he didn't pay his mortgage. And then Rigdon comes down and basically forecloses on him. And then Pratt turns around and says, "That's unfair. You know, you should be, you're your prophets. You should take sympathy on this poor soul. You know, and you guys are extortionists and all this kind of stuff." That's what he's saying, okay? And so you can get the picture, but I'll put that back further. When he moved into Ohio, I've got the tax records of his property. And so the famous story in the autobiography is he leaves his wonderful place, you know the story, and he goes out and he finds the Book of Mormon, and then he gets converted. He's called on this mission, and then he goes out in the famous Stew Boy incident. And in these documents, I've got a little thing from the Painesville Telegraph, and we've got the actual incident of the Stew Boy incident, not the 1854 version that he wrote in the autobiography.
Can you explain that for folks that aren't as readily engaged in... Talk about the Stew Boy incident. Give us some context here so people can understand this.
Now my wife's going to tell me to shut up because I have a tendency to rattle on because I get excited about Brother Pratt, you see. But the Stew Boy incident is where they went on the mission to out to the areas out there. They actually went to Ohio. Actually, Parley P. Pratt knew a lot of the people in the Ohio area. And when I did my research, and he was in Russian Township, and I've got all the tax records, all the land records, and all of the stuff for Pratt. And so when he leaves, there's a bunch of people that are his neighbors, and he joins the Rigdon movement at that particular time. He knew Sidney Rigdon. He knew several people. And so when they do the Lamanite mission, he's called back, and he goes back to that area. Now, when he left, he didn't pay his bills against his property. So when he comes back through the area, Mentor, and one of his neighbors in Russian Township was a guy by the name of Elias Peabody. Now, Elias Peabody happened to be the jailer, okay, in the famous Stew Boy incident, you see. And so this is where they arrest Brother Pratt, and they stick him out, and his autobiography said, this is all frivolous, this is all persecution, they're doing their stuff. But in this, and then we have the incident where he goes in and, well, in the original, with the judge brings him forth, and he has with one of the other brothers sing a hymn in court. And he recites and calls them to repentance in the original source. It's not quite in the autobiography. And then in the Painesville Telegraph, it says that he escapes out into the Missouri area
and all that sort of thing. Now, we know the famous Stuboy incident where he has Elias Peabody, and he says, well, I'm going to leave. And he goes out, and he says, well, what will happen if you leave? And I'll send my dog Stuboy after you. You all know this story. And then he goes out, and he runs, and he says, well, I think, and he's a very prolific writer, and he does it very well, and gives you that information relative to, he just sent Stuboy on, and he passed them, and it's a wonderful story. And so there's confirmation of that, but now did you see, he doesn't mention the fact, and I went through all these tax records from 1829 with all of his stuff, so I can give you an idea of why they were arresting him, okay? And so that gives you kind of a little bit different perspective of Pratt.
Do you have any other comments down there? Okay, all right. I wanted to jump back. You had mentioned, Steve, a little bit about the difference of, you know, the Pratt that they would, folks would encounter in his autobiography as opposed to the Pratt that he encounters in the papers that are being published. I wanted to hear from some of our other panelists on some of their insights regarding that difference of the autobiography versus, you know, the Pratt that we're seeing here. If we could.
Well, I think Matt and Terrell in the biography hit it just a little bit. I think you used the word hyperbole or something like that in there. He
it's
did
a gentle word.
Huh?
It's a gentle word.
Yes, gentle word. Tended to exaggerate. What I find in this, and in looking through the materials, is, and I think Steve alluded to this, but I find the real person. For me, it always comes back to that part. I can go through and I can read Stuboy and I can read all those stories, and it's a wonderful story, and we can get faith-promoting kinds of ideas from some of this stuff. But I'm interested in the man. I'm interested in his family. I'm interested in what happens at home. I'm interested in the kinds of interaction that he has with his wives, with his children. And I get that through the letters. I get that through a lot of these documents. Now, my interest, of course, I'm interested in Marianne Frost because she was born and raised in Maine. My wife was born and raised in Maine. And so when we go to Maine every year, there's a lot of this area then that I've been able to become very familiar with. And so when McClellan talks about taking the conference up and preaching in Farmington, there's a wonderful little Italian restaurant in Farmington, right across the street from Rennie's department store. And if you ever go to Maine and you don't go to Rennie's, you've not been to Maine. And so it really is a matter of then taking some of this, internalizing it, and then saying, okay, this is my grandpa, and I want to know what he was like as a person. And I get a lot of that through this material.
There is value in being able to strip away kind of the administrative functions, right, the apostolic aspect of his life, and to see the man.
And this is really the impetus behind the problem in 1837,
right,
when he writes Joseph Smith.
Yeah.
He is just broke, and he feels like he's being taken advantage of, and he has nothing. And he rebukes Joseph Smith in Sydney. I mean,
it's pretty scary.
Oh my gosh. but if he was just a man of poverty. Matt mentioned his romanticism a little bit. Romantic, I mean.
He was definitely.
I'm just going to read this. Now, this is what's the sad part about it is the marriage with Marianne crumbles, right, and they become quite bitter.
Yeah, they do.
But he's lost Thankful, and he marries this Mary Ann Frost Stearns. She stays with him for 3 months in the jail. She leaves. She writes him a letter, and this is what he writes back. I generally go to sleep with my thoughts drawn out in prayer for you and the children. And in my night visions, I often see you and my little babes, but it is always at a distance, which forever disappoints me in my dreams. O Mary, why do you forever fly from my visionary pursuit? But never mind, dreams are nothing. It is your own dear self in open day that I wish to see. Boy, that's really sweet. And it's just sad to see that relationship, probably because of plural marriage, I think we could say, deteriorated. But he was intensely in love with this second wife. She brought him great companionship and happiness. And where would you get that in the autobiography? There was just no way. There's a real tender man who loves his companion. And so you see the inner self, not that public kind of persona that he would like to portray. I might just mention, kind of maybe in context with this a little bit, and I think you dealt with it really well, you and Terrell, in your book, but Richard Bushman did not put in his book about The Silence She Fiends, if I remember right.
Oh, do you want me to talk about that?
Well, you go ahead then.
We got the last question.
Well, one question, and this will probably dovetail with this, but yeah. My final question before we open it up to questions from the audience was a sense of if you can identify one document that you find particularly significant, unusual, or surprising that you want to share with the audience.
Okay, yeah.
Let me start.
You go ahead and start. I've got there's some that are really surprising, and we got kind of I've got kind of a revelation that I need to talk about. You go ahead.
Yeah, this goes back, and it's another portion of a letter to Mary. And to me, this just really expresses where he is at the time. He's in jail. Dear Mary, I know not how to express my feelings concerning this long absence from you and our little ones. I hardly dare to trust my fingers with a pen to write on the subject, lest I should express feelings which would increase your sorrow, or lest I should ask that of you which would influence you again to suffer with me in prison, which request I know would be more than I have the right to ask of you and more than you are bound to fulfill. You have already had more trouble and affliction in your union with one whose whole life has been little else but a constant round of misfortune, grief, and suffering than most persons have to endure during a long life. And I am far from wishing you to suffer more for my sake. If I had foreseen the troubles which you would have been called to endure for my sake, I would have never asked for your hand, nor clasped you to my bosom as my lovely bride. But so it is. We are torn from the society of each other. Locks and bars, rivers and distance separate us. And still, I love you. But I'm doomed to languish out long months and perhaps years, deprived of your society while my little ones grow and change their size and appearance without one sweet kiss or fond embrace from the father who loves them dearer than life. For what then do I live? Is it more than I can endure? Excuse me, it is more than I can endure. Oh, that the Lord would take me home to rest where the wicked cease from troubling and the weary are at rest. If I could have my choice, I would choose to depart speedily and be with Christ rather than live any longer shut from the society of all who are near and dear to my heart. Perhaps this desire will not be granted me, but I must leave the subject. The Lord's will be done.
Okay, now there's kind of an interesting letter that I haven't written the introduction to. And the reason I haven't written an introduction to, because in 1837, and most people don't know about this little document, there's a little epistle from Parley P. Pratt, and I've got the copy of the actual original on up there, okay. This is an epistle after Parley P. Pratt came back from Canada, and after the thing, he was planning on going to Europe. This was before the situation with the call of Heber C. Kimball. He prepared an epistle that he was going to introduce
the gospel to the people. In this epistle, he gives the history, the early history of the church. So I'm going to read a little bit of this. I can't read it all because it's long, but I'm going to read you one little part here. Okay, let me start here. Enabled to obtain an... Okay. In Manchester, Ontario, County, New York, there resided a family by the name of Smith, who had formerly immigrated from the state of Vermont. They were neither learned nor wealthy, but by the cultivation of the earth with industry and economy, they were enabled to obtain an honest livelihood and to maintain a respectable standing in society. One of the sons of Mr. Smith, whose name was Joseph, was led at an early age to seek the Lord with repentance and prayer. By seeing the confusion of the churches, he concluded something must be wrong. He dare not step forward in any system of doctrine until he could ascertain which was right. He therefore called upon God in the name of Jesus with earnest prayer many times, praying the Lord to reveal himself unto him. While in this state of mind, he was visited by a holy angel whose garments were whiter than snow and whose countenance was as lightning. And he said, Joseph, thy prayers are heard, and God hath sent me to make known to you the things of which you have asked. Now I have a whole huge footnote there. The angel then unfolded to him the prophecies concerning the latter-day glory, the gathering of Israel, the coming of the Lord, and the destructions and the final overthrow of the fallen or apostate churches who had all departed from the laws, changed the ordinances, broken the everlasting covenant, having widely departed from the apostles' doctrine. The angel also made note to him that all children of God, on those who would hearken to the voice of truth, must be gathered out from the fallen church and be planted upon one of the pure gospel of Christ. It goes on and on, talking about the appearance of Moroni, talking about the 1827 thing of the plates. This is an early account of the first experiences. Now, my first thing when I first read this, and I read this years ago, was the first vision in here. Now, he talks about prayer, that the Lord answered him many times. To parley, the key was the Book of Mormon. I went through an extensive research on this. I went, for example, when he had his voice of warning, he talks about the Book of Mormon, and the first vision wasn't really published till 1840 by Orson Pratt's Remarkable Visions. That's the first publication of First Vision. So this is an exciting document. This is an early account by Parley P. Pratt himself of the early situations of the early church. Seriously, this very significant document, okay. Now, so I need to write an introduction to explain. I went back through on revisions of his Key to Theology, Voice of Warning. There are several revisions. His first Voice of Warning didn't even have the name Joseph Smith in it. He didn't even have his name in there. The second one, he didn't either. On the third rendition, then he quotes the Remarkable Visions portion of Orson Pratt's text, all right. But he doesn't include the first vision part. He includes the Moroni part. So to Parley, the key thing was the appearance of Moroni. Think of his hymn, an angel from on high, the long, long silence broke, you see. And so I went back through in 1842 when he was the editor of the Millennial Star, and even when they published Joseph Smith's history, where the first vision was there, there's no writing that I got in any discourse where Pratt talks about the first vision. He never does, okay? Now he publish it. He did, even when he has the opportunity, he with his Orson Pratt publishing it earlier, he doesn't do that. So to me, this is a very significant document.
That's exciting. We have about 15 minutes left in our session. Please, Alex and Matt, if you can. If there are documents that you can think of.
I think we can go ahead and open it up.
Yeah, I'm fine. Okay. It's kind of hard to select.
Okay.
Yeah,
a lot of good stuff.
Really like. All right, does anybody from our audience have questions? Please.
I have a question about plural marriage.
Okay, let me tell you, I think this collection will be...
What is your question?
Yeah. You have a plural marriage question.
I've got a question too, but...
I need to talk to him because, okay... Okay, I know. I'm glad we, because this is out of this first volume, but let me tell you, I know a lot about plural marriage in the Pratts. I've got every conceivable thing you can imagine on Pratt and plural marriage. Seriously.
Actually, how about Joseph and being Marianne?
I've got several documents on that. I think I'll answer that question this way. I have a document. It was kind of sad because Marianne Frost's thing is somewhat complicated. So let me give you a little bit of background. Parley P. Pratt, when he married people, he had a tendency. His first wife, Thankful Halsey, was 10 years older than he was. She was married to a guy by the name of Joseph Hand. So he married a widow. Now, when she had her first child, when she was at that particular time, she died, and then the baby was given to somebody else, and then he married Marianne Frost. Marianne Frost was married to a guy by the name of Nathan Stearns. She had a daughter, and this was quite a family there. Marianne and Nathan Stearns, they loved each other a lot. I mean, all of this stuff, it was quite interesting. And so I really was fascinated with the family life, and I could go into that a little bit. But when I got into, because I've got a bunch of stuff on the Frost side from the women, let me tell you, in this collection, the ladies are my favorites, even more than Pratt. When I look at Agatha Walker, and I know these people, Belinda and Mary Ann, and all of the women, that's the real story. We talk about the Pratts and all this sort of thing. I think a good example, not only with Pratt, but it's like Wilford Woodruff. We have Wilford Woodruff over there in England having all these baptisms. And back in Nauvoo, back in the areas, here's Phoebe losing a child and all kinds of problems. Okay. That's a similar thing with Pratt. Now let me finish this other thing with her, okay? When it came to the time of when polygamy was first began, I'll just lay it out. When Pratt came back from England, a lot of the women that he asked to be plural wives, or later plural wives, were from England, because he went over to England with his wife, and they were there. He was one of the only apostles that took his family over there. He took all of the family, his wife and the kids, and all of that. When they got back from England and they came into Nauvoo, this is when Parley P. Pratt first learned about plural marriage. There was a late Kimball letter that was sent to Heber C. Kimball, which talks about when Pratt learned about plural marriage and how Marianne kind of railed against it to a certain extent, and Vlate had to talk to the both of them. But it says in the letter that they proceeded to do this. And so then Vlate says that they would be shocked in the person that Parley P. Pratt chose to be his plural wife. His first plural wife was a woman by the name of Elizabeth Brotherton. Now the reason that they were shocked was because earlier a man by the name of Brigham Young had proposed to a woman by the name of Martha Brotherton. Martha Brotherton said no. She went out and published a letter, which was famously used by John C. Bennett and all this sort of thing.
And this woman was basically castigated by people, even her own family. And that's what they were talking about. So Parley married Mary Elizabeth Brotherton at this time, at that particular juncture. Now, in later, later, when they had higher ordinances in the gospel, there's a part in that particular time frame in Wilfred Woodruff's journal where he talks about when Parley received the highest ordinances, that Marianne, there were some questions that Marianne had because she was married to Stearns. And who should she be sealed to, Parley or Stearns? And so there was a discussion. And so when Parley received those first ordinances, Marianne wasn't in the picture here. And then there's a little incident that I think is true. When Parley came back from England, he went out on a boat trip, and they had a little excursion out there. Joseph said to him, these two sisters ought to be married to the same man. This was Mary Ann and Olive Gray Frost. And I've got some material on Olive Gray Frost as well. This is the Frost family we're talking about. Later, Joseph Smith was married to Olive Gray Frost. And then later, when there were problems between Joseph, and I'm not going to go into the Sarah thing because, there's Sarah Pratt, there's the Sarah Pratt situation with Orson Pratt. I've got all the material on that as well, and so we need to talk. And so there was some difficulty between the two Pratts on that. Later, when Pratt was having problems with Mary Ann, this was 1845, the reason she did is when he adopted plural marriage, he was sent on the Eastern States Mission, and he took my great-great-grandmother with him, who he had just married, and took her out east. So when I got out into the Eastern States, there was some of the apostles, other things there that they were upset at Pratt for bringing a different woman with him than he had, that was his first wife. Now, Belinda, who's who this was, she becomes with child, and so he comes back from his mission in 1846, and that's when there were real problems with Mary Ann. And him, there was a thing, an incident in the temple where the two brothers had problems, Sarah and the others, and they did that. And then the situation took place where in the temple, Mary Ann was sealed to Joseph Smith for eternity. And that whole business. Now, years later, after all this took place, the children of Parley P. Pratt, Moroni, wrote a letter to first to Brigham Young, and then he wrote a letter to Taylor and asked who should he be sealed to as a child. Should he be sealed to his father? Should he be sealed to, to Joseph, because he knew about the thing? And I have the response from Taylor, who said basically, had Joseph lived, he would have married her, and Parley would have been raising up kids to Joseph. And so he told the boy that you need to be sealed to Joseph. And so that's what they did. Now, if you can look in the genealogical records, I don't think that's the case today. But see, so it's a little bit complex. So when I went through the thing, I know Brian there, we talked a little bit about this, and so I I think that kind of gives you a nutshell on the complications.
Can I jump in real quick?
We have run out of time. The Parley Pratt Papers, Letters, and Documents, Volume 1 will be published by Greg Coford Books. Please join me in a round of applause for our panelists. Thank you so much.